This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why are we in this financial crisis? Why was it allowed to get to the point where Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson now warns that we will face dire consequences unless Congress approves a $700 billion bailout? What are the consequences Paulson's warning about? And even if we go forward with the bailout, what kinds of problems will we still face? We've invited Gretchen Morgenson to explain what's going on. She's a financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times and won a Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of Wall Street. We recorded our interview this morning. Gretchen Morgenson, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, we've been told by Henry Paulson that unless the Congress agrees to the proposed $700 billion bailout package, we will face disaster. Give us a sense of what he means, like what would likely happen if we didn't do this big bailout.
Well, everyone probably who's listening, and I'm sure you, Terry, know that we already face disaster, regardless of whether this plan goes through or doesn't go through. That's the very reason why they're scrambling to put together a plan. We are facing financial disaster or Armageddon or whatever word you want to use because of a combination of very lax lending, extremely large uses of borrowed money, also known as leverage, and a deregulatory viewpoint or approach that really took a hands-off kind of approach to the financial system. Those three things together have led us to the edge of the cliff.
And what is the cliff? Like, what happens at the other end of the cliff if you fall off it?
Well, as you know, several firms have fallen off the cliff. Other firms have been driven into the arms of larger financial entities that can possibly, you know, absorb them and not cause them to fail outright. We've had the failure of Bear Stearns. We've had the failure and bankruptcy filing of Lehman Brothers, two venerable names on Wall Street, as you know. What has happened here is that these firms took outsized risks with their own money and then borrowed more money to take those risks. And when you have that kind of a setup, when you have borrowed money and your assets that you've borrowed to buy decline in any value, you really are then asked for more money. What happens is the underlying assets that you've purchased are the collateral that support the loan that you have taken out. It's like a mortgage on your house. If your house declines in value and your loan then exceeds the amount of the house value, then you're underwater. It's essentially the same thing that these brokerage firms were doing. They were borrowing money, they made bets, the bets went bad, and then they had to put up more collateral, which they didn't have.
So at the risk of sounding stupid, what does that mean for everybody else?
Well, you need to have some certainty among the population that such things as money market funds, for instance, are not going to fail as a result of this. Money market funds have become a real choice of most people, really, to sort of a place to stash their cash when they're not investing it or when they might need it. It's a very kind of liquid form of sort of safe keeping for your money. And, you know, there were some situations earlier this week and last week where money funds did start to go below $1, which is their sort of net asset value that they like to stay at. And people just had no concept that you could actually lose money in a money market fund. People were thinking that that was the same as having a bank account that was insured. So you see, this has a spillover effect, Terry. These problems at, say, Lehman Brothers have a spillover effect. It was the fact that the money market fund owned the debt of Lehman Brothers that was then in bankruptcy that caused it to go below $1 a share. We're all very interconnected in this world. And so when one company fails, the potential for having this kind of domino effect of spreading failure and spreading problems into such areas as, like I explained, money market funds that seem to be completely unrelated.
You said something in your first answer that is still sending a chill down my spine, which is that even with this $700 billion bailout plan, we could still be facing disaster.
Well, first of all, a $700 billion bailout plan that does not describe to me with certainty how they are going to value these assets that the taxpayer is going to be backing, that's a disaster right there. Because how do I know that they're not going to pay too much for these assets that you and me and my son and everyone else's children and ad infinitum are going to actually be paying too much for troubled assets to get bankers out of trouble? And bankers got us into this mess. Why should we be rescuing them? I understand that we're in a very, very difficult position and a frightening position, but I want to be absolutely certain, and every taxpayer should want to be certain, that we are not going to be asked to spend more money than we ought to, simply to bail out people who made very big mistakes and took very big risks.
How did the situation go so quickly from the Secretary of the Treasury telling us that the crisis is being controlled to suddenly you have to pass this bill immediately or else the whole system is going to crash? There's no time to think about it. There's no time to debate. Stop asking for changes. You've got to do it right now. How could that happen so quickly?
That's a good question, and one that I don't know the answer to, but I'll tell you this. It really makes me suspicious.
Tell me what your suspicions are.
Well, my suspicions are that we were not told the truth in the beginning. Secretary Paulson, Ben Bernanke, a whole cast of characters rolled out all through 2007, really up until September of 2007, saying that it was contained. This problem would be contained to subprime. Well, anybody with a brain, anybody with eyes in their head knew that it was not going to be contained because nothing ever is nowadays because we're all so interrelated. So that was a lie. And so you have very little integrity among these people, it seems to me. Why should I now believe what they're saying, that I should hurry up and pass this bill or support this bill or agree to its terms, which are not even really detailed, when these people weren't telling me the truth 5 minutes ago?
Well, there's also the question, if these people weren't able to rescue the financial system before, why do we think they can do it now with the $700 billion?
And why do we think $700 billion is going to be the number? Could it be more?
Mm-hmm. Let's go through what the basics of the bill say and then look at what the lobbyists are trying to do behind the scenes. What is Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, asking for?
They're asking for approval to have a fund, taxpayer-funded kind of pool of money to buy troubled assets off of banks' balance sheets. They hope that this will then allow the banks to kind of recapitalize themselves, get healthy, and start lending again. One of the unintended consequences of the period we're in where banks are hobbled by these bad loans is that they retrench on lending. They rein in their lending to even the most creditworthy customers, whether it be a company or an individual who's trying to buy a home. So we need the wheels of commerce to be greased, and lending is that grease. And so as long as those wheels are not turning, we are, you know, threatening the overall economy. So they want to get these loans off the books so that the banks can feel confident about lending again.
What are the troubled loans that this fund would attempt to buy back?
Well, mostly they are mortgages, mortgage securities, pools of mortgages that have been sold to investors. These are some of the loans that were made at the tail end of the housing boom, 2005, 2006, and 2007, when really you didn't even have to be ambulatory or have a pulse to get a mortgage. It was just so much free money floating around that, you know, my cat could have gotten a mortgage on a house. So these were very, very iffy loans. They were made with the kinds of aspects where they would increase the interest rate dramatically after 2 years or 3 years, really putting the borrower in a difficult position if they couldn't pay that increase. So these are really at the heart of the problem. And there were so many of these loans made that banks are really, really troubled by them. There are also other loans that by sort of association have gotten hurt as well. Corporate loans, you know, that are also having, they're also feeling the same effects of the bank problems that we're seeing. Heavy leverage, too much leverage on, say, a commercial real estate property. So you really do see mostly mortgages here, but you'll also see corporate loans and other items as well.
Now, there's also those credit default swaps, and these are the financial instruments that have been compared to weapons of mass destruction. Can you give a shot to explaining what they are?
Sure. And they really are, Terry, central to the bailouts that have been made. And they're sort of back to the old interrelationship theme that I had earlier. Credit default swaps are a kind of insurance that are written by or sold by financial institutions, mostly banks, but also some insurance companies like AIG. What they do is they insure against a possible default by an issuer of debt. Take a company, General Motors. Let's say you own that bond and you're worried that maybe there's a chance that something bad would happen to General Motors. You can hedge your bond holding or reduce your risk by holding that bond by buying insurance against the possible default by General Motors. Now, these are contracts. They're not technically securities. They're contracts that are privately written between entities on terms that you and I don't know, typically 5 to 7 years, but it can be less. And they all can be very different. The person, the entity that sells the insurance gets a premium, and the person who buys it pays that premium and has the protection. Now, where these come into the situation is that as more and more entities have gotten into trouble, financial entities, banks, as more of these mortgages have failed, the insurance that was written on some of these debt issues has become more likely to be needed, more likely to be cashed in. It's like a fire is raging up the street towards your house that has insurance on it. Now the insurance that you've bought out and paid for all these years, it looks likely that you're going to have to put in your claim. And so what's happening is the insurance companies, the banks that have written this insurance are now being asked to pay on it. And a lot of those entities never thought in a million years that they would have to pay out on this insurance. They thought it was all just a way to get premium income and that the risk was minimal.
And they don't have the money to pay it.
Well, they may have the money to pay it, but, that's coming at a time when they're also under the crunch of having bad loans on their books. So, yeah, this is a real risk for them that they're going to have to raise more capital, possibly, to pay these off. So that's a very central part to this equation, these credit default swaps. And the amount of insurance that has been written out there is $62 trillion. Now, that doesn't mean that $62 trillion is going to have to be paid by somebody to someone else. But that's the amount of insurance written. And so it's a very big number. And at some of these banks, credit default swaps are huge, huge exposure.
So do we have $700 billion to use in this package if the package passes, and that's supposed to somehow protect us against these over $60 trillion worth of credit default swaps?
Well, I think the thought is, once again, that if we get the troubled loans off the bank's balance sheets, they can start to get strong again. And it'll sort of stanch the blood flow, or it'll put the fire out, you know, back to that metaphor that, you know, the fire brigade is on the scene here and they're trying to, you know, put out the fire. And one way they can do that is to remove the bad assets from the balance sheets and move on, allow the banks to, you know, regain some of their capital strength, start lending again. Then you wouldn't have the risk of defaults, which would trigger the insurance that would need to be paid, and we can maybe get back to normal. I think that the Democrats are trying to bring a little bit of help to Main Street, you know, that allowing for more modifications of the bad loans, giving some relief to the borrowers who are facing default and foreclosure. That's one element. Another element that I think is crucial before anybody should consider this is that the taxpayer, if they are going to put $700 billion towards this fund, should have some upside to it. It should not just be, okay, here's my $700 billion. Go save the banking world and, you know, maybe pay it back sometime. Why not give some, you know, upside profit potential to the taxpayer, which is precisely what happened in the Chrysler bailout. And it worked in that case. You know, it seems to me outrageous that we are being asked to put up $700 billion and not get something in return that's more than our money back. If these loans, okay, let's say these loans that the $700 billion fund is buying, let's say that they perform better than we expect right now in the doom and gloom era we're in. I want to see the taxpayer get some of those benefits. Mm-hmm. And how you would structure that is put something in there like a stock warrant or some kind of a way to capture the upside if there is any. I think anyone in the business world would structure the deal that way. So why shouldn't the taxpayer have the deal structured that way?
Now, you described the credit default swaps, which are part of the problem here in the financial crisis. And you've said that part of the reason why we're in this crisis is deregulation and lax regulation. These credit default swaps were never regulated at all. Although they function like insurance, they're officially not called insurance, although the insurance industry is regulated, these credit default swaps are not because they're not officially insurance.
Right.
Is there a movement now, since these default swaps are such a big part of the problem, to regulate the credit default swaps?
Well, yesterday the governor of New York came out and said that they want to institute a plan with the insurance commissioner, the superintendent of insurance in New York, want to institute a plan where anyone who writes these contracts for an entity that owns the underlying bond would have to become an insurance company, would have to become registered as an insurance company. Now, that will have the effect of, I think, driving some of these entities that are writing the insurance out of the business because they don't want to have to be regulated in that way. But that's just a proposal, and I don't know where it's going, and I don't know whether it will actually go into effect.
Is the banking industry trying to prevent any regulation of the credit default swaps?
They have always tried to prevent regulation of them, and I'm sure they are continuing. I don't have any firsthand knowledge of activities right this minute, but it's always been a big part of that world that, it could police itself. It was not something that needed oversight. These were private contracts by sophisticated parties. You don't need to protect them because they are not individual investors. However, you know, as Warren Buffett has so ably said, they are financial weapons of mass destruction, and so ultimately maybe the individual investor does have to be protected from them.
If lax regulation, or in the case of the credit default swaps, no regulation is part of the problem that created the financial meltdown, and if the solution to the financial meltdown being proposed by the Secretary of the Treasury doesn't address the regulation of these credit default swaps, are we kind of putting a Band-Aid on the problem without actually solving the underlying problem?
Well, I think what the Secretary of the Treasury is trying to do right now is just get something going on the books as far as a bailout plan. I think if he had tried to weave anything to do with credit default swaps into this, it would have slowed down the process, I'm sure, in his view. This is really an attempt to try to solve the extremely immediate need, which is that assets are declining in value. The banks are being hurt by the asset declines. They're being required to put up more collateral, which they don't have. and it's a kind of a spiral, downward spiral. What he is trying to do is to stop that right now. And so it's not kind of loaded up with a lot of other, you know, regulatory language or that kind of thing. I think it's just a sort of let's staunch the bleeding right this minute, and then we'll talk about other things.
What is happening behind the scenes that you know about in terms of the banks lobbying for things that they want in the bailout plan?
Well, this particular bailout plan presents the typical conflict of interest that I find so, you know, constant on Wall Street. Here it is. I am a bank. My assets are losing value. I'm in trouble. I need the taxpayers' help. I want to sell those assets at the best possible price that I can get for them. Because if I have to sell them, let's say they're worth right now 40 cents on the dollar. If I have to sell them for 20 cents on the dollar or 15, I have to take another write-down on those assets on my books. That means another loss. That means another hit to my capital. And I don't want to do that if I don't have to. Now, look at the taxpayer's point of view. Taxpayer says, look, I'm being asked to put up $700 billion. I want a good bargain. I don't want to overpay for these bad assets. I want to pay what they're worth. What's the value? If it's 15 cents on the dollar, that's what I'm paying, not a penny more. So you see the conflict. You see the problem. The bank wants the higher price. The buyer, the taxpayer in this case, wants the lower price. What's the price going to be? Who is the favored party in the transaction? I don't know about you, but I have a feeling that with all the lobbyists lining up in Washington, that you and I are not going to be the favored party.
You know, the banks have their lobbies. It's a campaign season. All candidates are looking for money right now. One of the scary possibilities here is that the bank lobbies will be paying money to congressional leaders in the hopes that they will pass the bailout package in a form that's more favorable to the banking industry. Is that a legitimate concern?
Absolutely. And not only will they throw more money at them now, but they will be calling in all the chits from the money that they've given to them up until now. You know, this is a constant problem with lobbying and donations. And so now the, you know, the special pleaders, as I call them, have their audiences with the lawmakers. Because they've paid so much money up until now, they will continue to, of course. They get their audiences and they get their say. And, you know, yes, it manipulates the system. And I'm afraid that the taxpayer who has no lobbyist is going to be on the short end of the stick.
Now, these toxic loans and financial products that have been compared to weapons of mass destruction, a lot of them have ended up in foreign banks because of the global economy. What is the bailout plan going to do, if anything, for the foreign banks that have this toxicity in them now?
Well, I think the bailout plan states that you have to have a U.S. entity in order to be able to sell loans to the fund. So I think it keeps, or it's trying to keep foreigners, you know, from sort of dumping their loans onto the taxpayer. But again, you know, Wall Street is very creative and knows how to get around these kinds of dictums. And what you could easily see someone do is offer to buy a foreign entity's loans, put them on their books, and then send them to the taxpayer as part of their problem. So, you know, kind of getting around that attempt to cordon it off only to the United States entities.
Part of the Bush administration's financial philosophy was that free markets without regulation correct themselves. Our markets are not correcting themselves. We are bailing them out. Does the situation we're in now officially disprove that theory that free markets without regulation correct themselves?
Well, I think it does. I'm sure you'll see, you know, people who are in still in the deregulatory mode go into some sort of gyration to explain why this little impasse does not illustrate that. But I think it certainly does. I think it proves it. And I think we are going to see more regulation going forward. But once again, it is extremely dispiriting to see that because there were regulations in place that could have been implemented more aggressively, that could have been helped forestall this whole mess.
Can you give us some examples of what regulations were in place that could have been enforced and helped to prevent the mess we're in?
Well, when you take out a mortgage, you are asked to, you know, look at the documents. You're presented with what is called a HUD-1, which is the Housing and Urban Development form that tells you approximately what the fees are going to be that you're going to pay. And there was never really any oversight of these forms and what the fees were. So there were just, it was a field day. It was a honeypot for mortgage brokers mortgage salespeople to load up fees on these borrowers that really were improper. And had someone at HUD taken a look at it, they might have stopped that, and they might have put something in place that would have policed that better or driven some of the more egregious players out of the market. Now, a lot of the most aggressive lenders that are now bankrupt were not regulated at all. They were sort of, you know, off in a corner. And, if bank regulators had been alert, as they, I'm sure, were or should have been, if they had been alert to what was going on at these entities, this anything goes, reckless, lax lending, they should have moved to include them in a regulatory framework instead of just letting them run roughshod over the borrowing public.
In 2000, there was legislation that was passed called the Commodity Futures Deregulation Act. What role do you think that played in creating the crisis that we're in?
Well, that act basically guaranteed that credit default swaps would not be regulated and not be overseen by any entity. So that really was the legislation that guaranteed that that market could grow like Topsy and not have anybody paying attention.
And Phil Graham was the person most behind it, Senator Phil Graham, who was a consultant, I mean, one of the top people in the McCain campaign.
He was one of the true believers. I'm not at all surprised if he would continue to say that that was not part of the problem. And there are other things that should have been done, and that was just a fine piece of legislation and has no ramifications today.
Is the American capitalist system being remade before our eyes right now?
I think it is. Wall Street is changing dramatically, seismically. You now do not have any more straight sort of investment banks or the largest investment banks, which were separated from commercial banks in Glass-Steagall, the legislation from the 30s. You now no longer have independent investment banks. The big ones are gone. Merrill Lynch is now a part of Bank of America. Bear Stearns has failed. Lehman Brothers bankrupt. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs have just recently been asked if they to turn into commercial banks or become banks so that they can be accept deposits, which is a more stable form of financing. That's a huge change. I also think that we are going to continue to see bank failures. So I think that that will be headlines among the financial world for quite a while.
So we no longer have investment banks. What is an investment bank?
An investment bank is a financial entity that helps companies raise money by helping them to issue stock or bonds. They advise on mergers and acquisitions between companies. They really provide those kinds of services. They also provide individual investors with investment advice, the ability to buy and sell stocks. But these kinds of barriers have fallen down over the years. And so, you know, it really isn't that there's going to be some kind of, you know, aspect of the individual's Wall Street experience that they can't have elsewhere. They're still going to be able to buy and sell stocks. They're still going to be able to get investment advice. It's just kind of an interesting moment in time that the investment bank business model, where you are you don't take individual deposits in, that thing has completely gone by the boards.
So as the capital system is being remade before our eyes, is the government taking a new role in capitalism through this bailout and through the bailouts that have happened in the past few weeks?
Yeah, and that's what I was alluding to earlier. The role is now one of cleaning up the mess. And this is why it's so crucial that the bailout or the cleanup have appropriate safeguards in it so that taxpayers are not put at a disadvantage, and so that there are elements in the plan that allow taxpayers to benefit or to even profit from this, you know, disaster. That's why it's so crucial, because you see what's happening is all of the gains that all of these wealthy institutions and chief executive officers and mortgage companies, all the billions of dollars that they made in recent years, is now being asked to be paid for by you and me and my children and your children and everyone else's. That's privatizing gains, socializing losses. So everybody is allowed to make hay while the sun shines, but when gloom and doom times come, when problems result because of no oversight and lax lending and, you know, anything goes approaches to these businesses, then whose dime is it? It's your dime and mine. And there's something really wrong about that.
The original plan that Henry Paulson asked for authority to buy assets from any financial institution at any price deemed necessary. And it says that neither the courts nor any administrative agency would be allowed to question these decisions. So it's basically saying no oversight at all. Now, Congress is asking for oversight, but I'm wondering, like, how do you even ask for a program like that of $700 billion with no oversight?
It's pretty brassy, don't you think? I mean, this is one of the elements that I find so troubling. It again goes back to the question of what is the taxpayer going to pay for these assets? Okay, so if there's no oversight, how are we to be certain that we're not overpaying? And in fact, if there's no oversight, how are we to think anything but that we are going to be overpaying? You know, it's all a part of this hurry up, we can't pay it, don't pay no attention to the details, we got to do this right now. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm very suspicious. $700 billion is being, you know, taken out of our wallets. Do we not have the right to examine the details, know who's going to be valuing the assets, be certain that they are not going to be overpriced so as to bail out the banks that made the bad decisions and got us into this ditch?
We are so in debt now between the war in Iraq and these financial bailouts, and we're depending on foreign countries to buy our debt by investing in our government bonds. China, for instance, owns a lot of our government bonds. Do you think the American government is confident that China and other countries that have been buying our debt will continue to buy it? And are we confident that they won't start selling the bonds that they already own?
Well, this is a crucial question, Terry, and you're getting right to the heart of the matter. Up until now, these foreign central banks and you know, huge investment arms and firms in other countries have been buying our debt, you know, and we are a safe haven. Our treasury debt is, you know, sort of the safe haven everyone runs to. But you saw what happened to the dollar yesterday. It got crushed because people are fearful that this $700 billion bailout will be inflationary and will also raise questions about the solidity of our debt. So, yeah, I think we are at a point in time when foreign countries' foreign investors have got to be wondering, is there an alternative that's safer than the United States government? You know, that's an enormous, troubling question. And I'm not saying that they've made that decision and that they will start selling. But boy, you sure do know that they're asking it, because here's a $700 billion bailout, and that has to have implications to drive the dollar down and to drive inflation up. Neither of those things are good for anyone who owns dollar-denominated debt instruments issued by Uncle Sam.
So the $700 billion bailout helps avert the banking crisis in the United States, but it makes us vulnerable in a different way in terms of how appealing our government bonds are. If other governments start selling their investments in U.S. government bonds or stop buying government bonds in the future, what are the implications of that for our economy?
Makes it harder for us to borrow money, obviously. It would make the Treasury have to pay more to borrow money, which raises costs, which is inflationary, which would drive the dollar down further. Our buying power would decline. You know, none of it is a happy picture. Now, maybe there's a silver lining in that because the dollar is down, our goods would be more attractive overseas than they have been. But, you know, that's a very thin silver lining as far as I'm concerned.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us before we allow you to leave that you think would help us understand what the heck is going on now?
I'm very discouraged by kind of the government response to this problem, really starting in early 2007, when people were not willing to call a spade. They were not willing to own up to what the problems really were. That has really been, I think, very dispiriting and troubling. But I really believe that America has what it takes to pull itself out of this morass. You know, the American people, I think, are extremely resourceful and extremely entrepreneurial, and they know the right thing to do. And I think that they would really rally behind a plan that made sense and that was presented in a way that they could be certain was not going to really hurt them financially. So I am positive on the American people. I just think we deserve better from our leaders in this very, very troubling time.
Now, here's another thing I'm wondering. You know, Henry Paulson has put together this bailout proposal, and the Bush presidency ends in January. And whether, you know, McCain or Obama wins, there's going to be somebody new in the White House. And it's likely, well, presidents often appoint a new Treasury Secretary when they arrive in the White House. So, you know, what are the odds that Paulson, who is putting this plan together, will actually be the person who follows through on it?
Probably the odds are not very good. I think that Mr. Paulson probably feels like he needs a rest himself. I think that this is going to be a plan that is going to be somebody else's problem, which makes it all the more important that we really iron out the details now so that we can be certain going forward that whomever runs it is going to run it to the best possible result for the taxpayer.
Well, that will be a heck of an important position.
Yeah, I don't want that job.
Well, I want to thank you very much for helping to explain some of what's going on. Thank you, Gretchen Morgenson.
I really appreciate
your appearances on our show.
Okay. Thanks, Terry.
Gretchen Morgenson is a financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. You can download podcasts of our interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of a novel by the Swedish journalist Stieg Larsson. He distinguished himself during his career by writing about the resurgence of right-wing extremism in Sweden. He died in 2004 of a heart attack at the age of 50, leaving behind, among other works, three novels in manuscript. The first, a suspense novel called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, has become a runaway bestseller in Europe and has just been published in the U.S. Maureen says Larsson's firsthand knowledge of the nastier aspects of Swedish history and culture endow his thriller with a hard-boiled intensity. The hard-boiled mystery is as American as apple pie, poisoned apple pie, that is, with a steel file baked into the filling. It's a literary genre that was born on the mean streets of early 20th century L.A. and San Francisco, mostly sunlit places where, as the sour saying goes, a person could rot without feeling it. But one of the most intriguing aspects of hard-boiled history is how the form has become enthusiastically embraced by writers outside of the United States. In fact, for the past decade or so, Sweden has been a popular pick for crime capital of the literary world, thanks to Henning Mankell and his fellow practitioners of Noir on Ice. The newest name in mystery to emerge out of the frozen north is that of the late Stieg Larsson. His debut novel, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, was a blockbuster when it was published in Europe, selling an estimated 2 million copies. Now, an English-language version, translated by Reg Keeland, has just been published here. A veteran mystery reader could spot the clues to this novel's runaway popularity as easily as Poe's detective, Auguste Dupin, spotted that purloined letter. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is a super-smart amalgam of the corporate corruption tale, the legal thriller, and the dysfunctional family psychological suspense story. It's witty, wrenchingly violent in a few isolated passages, and unflinching in its common sense, feminist social commentary. The social vulnerability of women is the underlying mystery with a capital M here, specifically the abuse, psychological and sexual, that's perpetrated against young and dependent women. Very late in the novel, one of our main characters, a reporter named Mikael Blomqvist, asks a serial murderer whose victims are often female emigrants to Sweden the simple question, why? The monster calmly answers, because it's so easy. Clearly, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo isn't geared toward those readers who favor gentle, Agatha Christie cozies. But its plot does consciously bow to Christie and her locked room, isolated island brand of puzzle. Here's the barest bones summary. Journalist Mikael Blomqvist is a man down on his luck. He's just been convicted of libeling a corporate mogul, and he's been sentenced to a jail term plus hefty fines. Out of the blue, Blomqvist receives an offer he can't refuse from a rival industrialist. Henrik Vanyar is in his 80s and has been tormented for the past 40 years by the mysterious disappearance of his grandniece, Harriet. On the day of Harriet's disappearance, the island where the Vanyars lived was blocked off from the mainland by a truck fire on the connecting bridge. How then did Harriet, or her corpse, vanish? Henrik tells Mikael Blomqvist that if he moves to the island and works for a year reinvestigating Harriet's disappearance, he'll receive not only a huge salary, but also inside information that will clear him of the libel charges. Blomqvist bites. But fortunately, through a turn of events too deliciously complicated to go into here, he's aided in his investigation by a 24-year-old brilliant computer hacker named Lisbeth Salandar. Salandar is a pierced, tattooed, painfully thin goth with major attitude problems. She's also the gal pal you want on your side when the creeps slither out from under their rocks. Larsson's multi-pieced plot snaps together as neatly as an IKEA bookcase. But even more satisfying is the antisocial character of Salandar, whose movements are described as quick and spidery. Certainly the utopian allure of traditional detective fiction had something to do with the omnipotent Sam Spades and Philip Marlowe's who made criminals quake and femme fatales swoon. The liberating fantasy of Salandar, at least for this female reader, has something to do with watching a woman operate who doesn't give a darn whether she pleases people or not. Salandar doesn't smile, knock back boilermakers, or eat moose burgers. She's not out to win friends or votes.
but I'm betting that this offbeat bad girl will win a lot of readers' affections.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. You can read an excerpt of the novel on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close the show with a recording by trumpeter and author Richard Sudhalter, whose books included a biography of Hoagy Carmichael. Sudhalter died Friday at the age of 69. This is his 1998 recording of the Earl Hines tune, A Monday Date.